Hi, everyone, and welcome to the NAIOP podcast, Inside CRE, featuring interviews with commercial real estate leaders who share industry and career insights. I'm Christopher Ware, Vice President of Business Development and Strategic Initiatives at NAIOP, and your guest host today. NAIOP, the Commercial Real Estate Development Association, is the development industry's leading source for education, advocacy, and connections that drive your business forward. Inside CRE is brought to you by Avis & Young. In today's episode, I'm speaking with geopolitical strategist Peter Zion. Peter combines an expert understanding of demography, economics, energy, politics, technology, and security to help clients best prepare for an uncertain future. With a keen eye towards what will drive tomorrow's headlines, his irreverent approach transforms topics that are normally dense and heavy to accessible, relevant takeaways for audiences of all types. Peter recently gave a captivating and outstanding keynote address at CRE Converge, and it was very much enjoyed by all there, myself included. Peter, it's great to speak with you again, and welcome to the podcast.
It's great to be back.
Thank you so much. So, geopolitical strategist. So what exactly is that, and how did you become one?
Totally accidentally. At my old company, I was the only generalist. So I ended up being the person that usually was put in front of clients because I could connect different things. And I tended to not pick fights with the clients over stovepipe topics. But it's all about translating the world for everyone. We're going through a period of demographic changes that were caused by geopolitical adjustments. And now we're seeing those geopolitical adjustments unwind at the same time that demographics has reached almost a terminal stage in a lot of countries. Mm. So everything about consumption and investment and production is in the process of being rewired. At the same time, we're going through deglobalization. So a lot going on. Whether the picture is good or bad depends on who you are and what you care about and where you live.
So I want to dive right in. I'm a fellow student of history, and it was very striking when you started your presentation with a big portrait of Comrade Stalin. And I think a lot of your thesis kind of coalesces around that. So the Allies win the Second World War. We do pretty much the opposite of what we did in the First World War, and we actually decide to engage in the peace. And a big part of that, and the whole goal of that, was to prevent Stalin and communism from taking over the world. And that birthed what you call the order. So what is the order, and what has it meant to us in a post-World War II economy up until recently?
Everyone focuses on containment, and it's not that containment was wrong or was, you know, not part of the solution, but there was an economic side to the containment of the Soviet Union as well. The order basically allowed countries who allied themselves with the United States to access the wider world for raw materials, inputs, energy inputs, and markets for manufactured goods, consumer markets, and the ability to shuttle goods around at any time without having to have a military escort, because the U.S. took care of security. Without that, we wouldn't have had nearly as many people on our side. The Europeans would have been a very different situation. They probably would have waffled at a minimum. A lot of them would have tried to be neutral. But most of all, this was a global phenomenon. And so it created a network of trade and interaction that eventually took on a life of its own. And when the Cold War ended, anyone who was trying to sit on the sidelines joined in, even though the United States no longer saw it as core to its interests. So we're in this weird world where the U.S. has become less and less engaged from a security point of view in maintaining the structures of globalization. At the same time, more and more countries have joined into the rubric. So all it takes is the United States doing nothing, and this can all fall apart all on its own.
The United States basically makes a bet and says, you know, we will be the navy of the world. We will facilitate free trade. And your end of the bargain is you don't become communist. Is that a fairly good summation?
Well, for the Japanese and the Europeans, it wasn't so much communist, it was Soviet. There are differences. Soviet.
Yes.
Right. For everyone else, though, it was basically a bribe to trade in the American manner. And, you know, broadly speaking, it worked pretty well.
And then the Soviet Union rudely collapses on us, and the old order starts to die out, but not before China rises onto the global scale. And I would say, and correct me if I'm wrong, China is very much a product of this order in terms of the facilitation of free trade. China is now in the system, but probably one of the most sobering quotes out of many from your presentation last week was that, quote, every day that China does not collapse is a gift because it gives us a day to prepare for what's next. And then you went on to say, count on nothing from China. They are going away. Everything they manufacture is going away. So unpack that a little bit for us, sure, because that's a central part of your presentation. And I think something that really opened a lot of eyes last week, China's collapsing. What's going on? Why is it happening? Give us the lowdown.
So there are, I mean, first of all, China was a Cold War ally. Remember when Nixon went to meet Mao, that was all about ushering the Chinese into the American strategic picture against the Soviet Union. And in that, the summit was incredibly successful. But that started two things. Number one, the Chinese started integrating themselves in the international system, which meant indirectly they were now very vulnerable to American security decisions. Because without the Americans keeping trade open for everyone, the Chinese have no way to access those markets that they need either for inputs or for outputs. So they are the most dependent upon Washington that they have ever been in their existence. And you've seen how politics have evolved in Washington. Mm. The second issue is demographic, and this is something that affects everyone to one degree or another. When you globalize, when you industrialize, when you urbanize, you move out of a subsistence agricultural environment into one where you're living in a dense population structure, usually in a city in a condo. Well, that changes the personal economics. Because back on the farm, kids are free labor. You have as many as you can. In town, they're just an expense. You have as few as you think you can handle. And that means for most countries, in less than a century, they've gone from having four, five, six, seven kids to one, two, three. In the case of China, they were late to the game. They didn't start to industrialize really until the late 70s. And all the technologies of urbanization had already been developed, so they were able to apply them in mass and with fury. And one of the things is when you urbanize later in the process, your birth rate drops faster because the urbanization process is faster. And if you move from living on a subsistence rice paddy to a high-rise apartment in a single generation, what we've seen is the birth rate in China hasn't just dropped, it's collapsed before you consider the impact of the one-child policy. We're now in a situation where it's reasonable to have a conversation about the Han ethnicity vanishing from the world before the end of the century. And we're already in an environment where there is no next generation of children or young workers in the Chinese system. They're dealing with the world's most rapidly aging workforce that will age out of an ability to sustain their own system within 10 years. So we really are very rapidly approaching the end. The problem for us, not for them, obviously they have lots of problems. The problem for us is in that 40 years when they industrialized and urbanized, they built the workshop of the world. And so much, especially for materials processing that the world needs, that we need, is done in China. And we now have to relocate a lot of that in a very short period of time. So we're in a race. Will China collapse before we can rebuild industrial plants elsewhere? And I don't have an answer for you. All I can tell is we're going to know within 5 years whether this is going to work or not.
You also pointed out in the meantime, labor rates in China have gone up, and I think you said by a factor of 14. Is that correct?
Since the year 2000, yes. It's the fastest increase in labor costs in human history.
So just since the year 2000. And compared to Mexican labor is what you said, like a third of that?
It's about 40 to 45% the cost, but it's about twice as skilled.
Wow. So we have the dual whammy of rapid urbanization, one-child policy, looking at a complete collapse of China as really a modern economy within the next decade. Is there any way that they can maneuver themselves out of that? Or is it just dyed in the wool, it's going to happen?
To poke the hole in my own argument, this has never happened before. So I'll fully admit that figuring out the details of this is very much a work in progress. But we have never had an economic structure on the planet before that didn't have enough young people to continue. So, I mean, what do you do when you run out of people who are under age 40? Because that's exactly the situation that the Chinese are in today. In theory, good policy could at least buy them time. But Chairman Xi has basically locked himself in a dark room and won't let anyone in. He's shot the messenger so many times that it's impossible for him to get the information he needs to make decisions, but he's also purged the entire Chinese system of all the other decision makers. So he's established himself at the top of the pyramid, but he won't let anyone approach. And so we're seeing policy failures throughout the Chinese system at a time that they could really use some thoughtful policy.
Correct me if I'm wrong. You've had some interesting comments on like automation and robotics. Mm-hmm. There's no salvation for the Chinese system, even if there's a radical breakthrough in AI automation technology. Why is that?
Well, if you assume that the technology is there, and if you assume that we can build the chips in mass, and if you assume that the capital is there and you can install it all very, 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 very quickly, theoretically, you can solve part of the production side of the equation. And that wouldn't be nothing. Now, all four of those contingencies are in question right now, I would argue. But let's just assume that all of those, that goes away and you can actually install the industrial plant. Yeah. That doesn't do anything for consumption. The Chinese have run out of people who, the people who are aged 20 to 45, that is the consumption class. Those are the people who are building homes and raising kids. And that's the class that doesn't exist in China. And there are even fewer people in their teens and even fewer people who are under 10. We're on a starvation diet here as far as consumption is concerned. They're more dependent upon the rest of the world now rather than less. And since there's only a three countries of size, economic heft, that are consumption driven anymore, India, the United States, not exactly fans of them right now, and Mexico, who's a competitor. So there's no play here.
And of course, the other thing with robots is they don't buy anything and they don't have children, at least not yet. So there's no way out there. One final question was about the only thing that could potentially save China would be a 1946 style United States takes over Germany type situation, Marshall Plan. We come in, they basically become a ward of the United States. And that's just not anything that China was ever going to go for. But I thought that was interesting that in your estimation is about the only lifeline that would even theoretically be possible.
And let's be clear that it's not on the table and it's not going to happen.
Of course. Right. Right.
Yeah. But China's in a situation now where the consumption levels are so low and the economic inefficiency is so high that they basically need the top to bottom economic restructuring and the world's greatest subsidy program from the outside world if they are going to maintain their existence as a country and their existence as an ethnicity. And those resources arguably aren't available even if the politics somehow miraculously lined up. The United States has its own issues. It's far more concerned with what's going on in Mexico in terms of securing its own future than subsidizing someone who sees themselves as a geopolitical competitor. And even if we wanted to, you would have to have a reduction in the standard of living of the average Chinese by at least 80% to get it within the realm of what the U.S. even could theoretically lift.
Wow. So not a good picture there. I'm wondering, you're sitting in Colorado, you're looking at the news or traveling around. What is going to be something that's going to catch your eye and you're saying, yes, the beginning of the end is now officially here for China?
So I'm actually in Boston today, but yes.
Boston.
We've had a lot of those things. So for example, when the power outages happened in 2021, rolling across China, you know, it took 6 months before anyone told Xi, and he had to be told by a foreign head of state what was going on in his own country. Gives you an idea of just how extreme the political breakdown is. The Shanghai Academy of Sciences, which are kind of like their wise men, are now saying that there's enough spare housing in the country for up to 3 billion people to put down roots. Just the scope of how broken this is just immense.
So is it really just going to be an issue of just one day stuff just stops showing up?
That is my concern. Information transfer within the system has become so constricted and the press protocols are now so dark. Just basic information exchange within the government is basically not there, much less information that comes out. So they basically criminalized due diligence investigations at this point. And they're starting to detain American CEOs who are traveling in the country. You know, we had no CEOs go to China for 3 years because of COVID. And then the first batch that come back, they give them anal probes, literally, to check to see if they're COVID. And then they arrest some of them or put them under house arrest. So, you know, this is not a relationship that is based on trust and mutual benefit. This has become very antagonistic, and the information flows reflect that. And so the only thing that we have to judge the health of the relationship by now is when the product comes out. And at some point, that's going to stop. And we're probably not going to have a lot of warning time.
Yeah. So there's like no lead time. It's just a matter of I ordered a piece of manufacturing equipment from China and I should get it in 6 months. And 6 months goes by, it's just not there and it's never coming.
Yeah. Now, in the Chinese defense, they are starting to update some of these back orders to give you an idea of maybe when you might get it. But like for a transformer, you're looking at 36 to 40 months already. I mean, there might not be a China in that kind of time.
40 months. Wow. That's amazing. Takeaway number one, China has maybe 10 years left. We have some time to adjust for that, but we need to get on it sooner rather than later.
Yesterday would have been a great time to start.
Yesterday would have been a great time to start unless we want to deal with just massive, massive disruptions to our supply chain. So I think that's a huge takeaway, number one. Number two, and the thing that, something that really stood out is, quoting your comments from last week, if you're going to take no advice from me on anything else, do this. Hire, hire, hire. Borrow, borrow, borrow. We are at the cheapest labor costs and the cheapest capital costs that we will see for more than a decade. Why? And what's driving this?
Sure. This isn't the Chinese.
This is not the Chinese. Yeah. So we're going back to the United States. We're back in the North American economy. So hire, hire, borrow, borrow. Cheapest labor costs, cheapest capital costs. What's going on there and what's that mean for the economy?
So a standard population demographic, you've got more children than young adults, than mature adults, than retirees. It tends to be a pyramid. But as you industrialize, that opens up into a chimney as the birth rate drops, but the death rate drops with it because of better medical care. Mm. But eventually, having fewer kids decade on decade, it starts to turn into an open pyramid where you get ultimately more retirees than mature workers, than young workers, than children. And once you get there, that's where China is. It goes terminal because there's no longer enough people to even theoretically fill it up at the bottom. Now, in the United States, we don't have that situation. We industrialize more slowly. We have more elbow room. So we're still kind of that chimney, but we've got these weird wiggles in our demographics, in part because of World War II, but mostly because when the GIs came back, they generated the baby boomers. Mm-hmm. So approaching retirement right now, the baby boomers are very wide. It goes in quite a way for Gen X. It comes out again for the millennials, who are the boomers' kids, and then goes back in for the zoomers. And that means as these generations age through life, they as a group shape our labor and our capital markets. Most of our labor, obviously, is in that 20 to 65 age group, with the unskilled at the lower end, the higher skilled at the upper end. And most of our capital generation comes from people aged 55 to 65, who are at the peak of their earning potential, but whose expenses have gotten under control because all the kids have moved out. The baby boomers, for the last 15 years, have been aging through that 55 to 65 year period. And so we've been in a very lush capital environment. You can argue too lush. That's part of the reason that the subprime crisis happened. But now half of them are retired. In the next few years, the other half are going to move into retirement. So all of their investment capital is being put into relatively unsexy things like T-bills because they're not going to be able to take the risk. Well, that means capital costs have tripled in the last 4 years. And they're going to triple again in the next 3 to 4 years as the rest of the boomers go away. We won't have a relatively inexpensive capital stock again until we have another large generation entering their mid to late 50s. That will be the millennials, and that won't happen until midway through next decade. So we have a 10 to 12 year period here where capital costs are going to go up and stay high, independent of the Fed, independent of the business cycle. That's just locked in now. The labor situation is somewhat similar. Gen X is a small generation with a low labor participation rate. They are now the bulk of the skilled labor. There are not enough of them. The millennials are many. However, because of the financial crisis and those negative stereotypes, which are true for half of them, they're relatively low skilled for their age bracket. So we're having some problems with the whole next generation. The generation below them, the Zoomers, most educated, hardworking generation we have ever had, but they're all antisocial and they won't do jobs in an office or outside. So if you need coders, you're in luck. If you need anything done that involves seeing another person, you're screwed. So we have to wait for a whole nother generation to be generated by the millennials and then grow up and get trained, well, they're not going to enter the workforce until 2045. So we're at the cheap, despite the increase in capital costs, we're at the cheapest capital we're going to see for 10 to 15 years. And despite the increases in the labor costs, we're at the cheapest labor supply we're going to see for 20 to 25 years. So when you look at what we need to do before the end of this decade with reindustrialization because of the Chinese situation, you need to do it now. You need to hire and borrow as much as you can, even if you don't have a business plan for it. I know that sounds horrible, but that's where we are. And anyone who waits is going to have to basically play catch up in an environment of ever rising capital and labor costs. So best of forward position.
Wow. I mean, do we have any salvation at all? Any help at all? China is falling apart. Europe's not looking great. Are people putting their money in the United States? And has that given us a lifeline, or is it just not enough?
It's definitely given us a lifeline. When I say a triple capital cost in the next 3 to 4 years, that includes the money that is flowing in. Okay. Last year, we probably got somewhere between $2 and $3 trillion of capital flight to the United States. Now, there's a financial conversation to be had here. Because when this stuff comes in, it goes into some very specific things. It likes residential real estate, and that's going to be retail investors are looking for a place to get their money out. And it likes T-bills because of the implicit government guarantee. They also like things that generate a rate of return. So if you can find something that checks those three boxes and market it to foreigners, you're going to make mad money and get lots of activity. So I'm a big fan personally of community development bonds or infrastructure bonds, because those are the sorts of things that the foreigners are looking for.
And some of the stuff that we need in this country anyway.
So I would argue it would be a good idea independently. Yes.
That's it. Like it. And related to that, we continue to be the place that most skilled labor wants to end up at.
We would need a legal shift to allow that.
Well, that was going to be my next point. So let's just assume, and this is almost fanciful, but let's just assume that Washington gets its act together and realizes the writing on the wall.
Oh, it will, just not this year.
Not this year. And who knows?
Not next year, or the year after.
Maybe. We'll see. How much? So let's say we change our immigration policy to be more friendly to foreign-born workers. Does that change that timeline at all? Or again, is it just not something at all to bank on in terms of, you know, we just don't.
I don't think we can bank on it for the purposes of this transition we need to go through. We go through these periods historically where we're more or less nativist. This is one of the more extreme ones for nativism. The problem we're having is that our immigration issue has been caught up in our political transition. Mm-hmm. So we've got to first pass the post system, which encourages very large parties, typically can't sustain any more than two, because each party has to get an extra marginal vote more than whoever they're running against. And so you tend to get very, very large groups of people under each tent. Well, that means that a lot of the factions that would be independent parties in some place like Asia or Europe are all together under the same tent. And economics and politics and social policy, you know, they're dynamic. So these factions rise and fall over time. And eventually the alliance that created party no longer works as society changes beyond the recognition of what it was when the parties were formed. So the last time we went through this in fury, it was the 1930s with the Great Depression and World War II. What we're going through right now is those factions are moving around. And so some factions have jumped ship, some swing voters have come into the coalitions, and the most important aspect of it for this part of the conversation is organized labor are no longer Democrats, they're swing voters. And they are arguably the second most hostile group in the American political spectrum to migration of any type. So as long as they are not Republicans or Democrats, no one in Washington wants to breathe a word about immigration reform, because the unions are the single largest voting bloc by number that is unaffiliated, and everybody wants to attract them into their coalition. And that means no immigration reform this year, next year, the year after, probably not until the next president, or at least the next presidential cycle. So I think we're locked in this kind of churn at least through, let's see, we're in 23, so at least through 2025. After that, maybe it will settle out, because we're going to have some very clear electoral defeats in the general election year after next, or is that, you know, crap, it's just next year.
I know.
and that is going to force a lot of people to make some very hard decisions about what it means to be a Democrat or a Republican. And then all of a sudden, we're in a new conversation. But we have to get there first.
Yes. So there's a lot between here and there, obviously.
And honestly, all the decisions we need to make on industrial policy and expansion, those needed to happen yesterday. And right. For most companies, they will have been made before the election.
Changing the topic just a little bit, there's a couple of things that that you've mentioned and has a direct applicability to what NAIOP members do on a day-to-day basis. So we have baby boomers retiring. You retire, you don't need to go to an office, at least for most people. The Gen Xers, myself included, you said you're an Xer yourself, value our time. Proudly Gen Xers, yay. The only thing that a Gen Xer hates more than going to the office is the commute to the office. And then you mentioned the Zoomers don't even want to leave the house, much less go to an office, much less leave their bedroom. So as an asset class, you're saying that office space is potentially massively overbuilt.
Absolutely.
Talk about that a little bit further. And is there a future at all for the traditional office, or is it just going to be very radically different as this new world economy unfolds?
Well, let's start with the Xers, because they're now the senior managers and the ones making the decisions here. Unlike the boomers, unlike the millennials that are very commonly two-income households, the Xers have always valued their time and their family more than their money. And now that has worked against them for most of their adult lives because they've been below the boomers on the totem pole. And so if you've got single income families and you're the low wage earners anyway, it's been rough. And we've seen the lowest levels of wealth accumulation for that generation until very recently. But recently, the boomers all started retiring. And all of a sudden, Gen Xers are finding themselves the senior staff in a labor-starved environment. And their financial position has expanded hugely in the last 5 years. And they've gone from the kind of the worst in history to the best. But they're not going to suddenly have their spouse enter the workforce. And so the numbers that are there are low. And the decision makers are generally hostile to the very idea of coming in anyway. So with the decision makers kind of turning on the office, that's already going to knock things down quite a bit. That before you consider that the Zoomers are a small generation and could never fill up the office anyway. And before you consider that they're an antisocial generation and won't take the jobs that require them to come in anyway. That just leaves the millennials. Now, the millennials get a lot of crap for a lot of reasons, most of it, which is very grounded in reality and data. But all the touchy-feely stuff that glues a company together, not just HR, but team building and collaboration, they are the best workers we have ever had. And they love being together in a group, and they're productive when doing it. So it's not just that the number of offices that we need are going to shrink. The offices that remain are going to look very, very different, with much smaller personal space and much larger group space to account for the fact that the millennials work differently than the boomers did before them. That's going to require an overhaul of office space. And the companies and the renters or rentees that can do that first are the ones who are going to survive. And everyone who's just waiting for us to go back to 2019, they're probably going to have to be repurposed as something else. Now, luckily, there's a lot of reasons to expect a lot of repurposing. Manufacturing models are changing. Not only do we need to double the size of the industrial plant, we're going to have a supply chain system that is much closer to the end consumer because it's going to be here. And anything commercial that you can turn into light manufacturing is kind of a slam dunk because you're already in the population center. So as 3D printing and things like it become more and more popular and the price point comes down, I can see a lot of these office blocks, especially anything that's not A-class, looking better and better and better. That will require some retooling as well. They're going to need a lot more power than they use now. But it's not like we have to level all of this stuff. This is not like the overbuild we have in China with residential.
Right, where they have entire cities that are empty. This actually segues really nicely into a comment that I heard you make on the Rogan podcast, and that is you consider yourself a green, but a green that can do math.
Makes me very lonely.
I bet it does. And you said you're a lot of fun at parties, but largely because you bring bourbon, which you know I can personally relate to that. But you aren't very bullish on EV technology for a variety of reasons, which is kind of surprising. It's a self-identified green, but again, a green that can do the math. In our sector, of course, in industrial real estate, especially in California, there's a huge drive for taking traditional combustion engines offline and replacing them with EVs, trucks replacing them with EVs, etc. But You have some pretty big red flags for that, just from a practical perspective and also from a carbon perspective. Can you enlighten us a little bit there, just on that sector and your take on it?
Well, let's start with the carbon approach. If you look at, say, Tesla propaganda, they'll talk about how your Tesla can break even in terms of carbon within a year. If you make up the data, I guess you can say that's true. But they assume that you're making your Tesla with 100% green energy and that you're filling it with 100% green energy. Now, the U.S. grid is getting greener by the day, but it's less than half green in California, much less nationwide. In fact, if you're in most parts of the East Coast, you're going to be running a coal car, which is going to take a while to break even. But mostly the issue is on the production side. China does the processing for most of this stuff. It's the one that generates most of the PVs and most of the batteries. And just to give you an idea, the power intensity required to make polysilicon for panels is 7 times as energy intensive as making aluminum, which is until now the most energy intensive processing we've ever had. And the Chinese, if they're not using soft coal, they're using lignite. So it's just the carbon bomb of just to get one of these vehicles on the road is immense. And if you're not using it in a place with a lot of green tech power generation, and that is not California, you're talking about well over a decade before you hit break even, assuming you can. The hyperbola that's involved here is pretty hostile. A bigger problem is whether or not we should. The question is whether we can. And if we're going to do the green transition with the technologies we have today, if we're going to do what we say we're going to do, then by 2030, we need to triple the volume of copper and increase the volume of nickel we have by a factor of 10, lithium by 20, graphite by 18, chromium by 14. It's a long list. We have never doubled the production of any industrial material that was already in use before in a 10-year period as a species, ever. And now we're going to do it for 20 different materials, and in some cases, not double it, but increase it by a factor of 10 or more? No.
We're not even talking like a World War II situation where we ramped up production to save the free world. Not even in that scenario did we increase production.
There's never been a scenario.
Never.
Ever. And we're going to have to do this for a number of different things. At the same time, globalization is breaking down. At the same time, we're going to lose the Chinese system for processing. At the same time, we're likely to lose most of the Russian stuff from a sourcing point of view. So we're going to have to do something that Americans really don't like to do. We're going to have to choose where to apply these technologies to have the best bang for the buck. And I would argue that on the whole, EVs were already a loss from a carbon point of view, forget the economic point of view. And so investing our limited labor and our limited capital and our limited time in something that just doesn't work doesn't strike me as a good idea. Now, I'm not anti-EV. A lot of people think they're great to drive. They're wonderful machines. But don't pretend you're helping the environment because you're not.
Yeah, the better investment, if I recall, something that you had talked about and I think would be relevant here is more investment in something like a wind technology in terms of actually reducing overall carbon as opposed to something like the electronic vehicle movement, which again, looks good, but maybe doesn't quite have the impact that we think it does.
Sure. I mean, there are some green techs that look very positive, especially if you apply them to the right geography. So Solar panels have gotten about twice as effective and have dropped dramatically in price over the last 15 to 20 years. And if you put them in a place like Arizona, they generate scads of power. So the American Southwest, roughly going from LA to roughly Midland, Texas, that's one of the best solar zones in the world. Carpet the things there. Wind is even better. Wind has the advantage, of course, of working at night. Wind blows at night. Sun never shines at night. And so putting turbines up and down the western parts of the Midwest and into the Great Plains, that's one of the great wind zones on the planet. And the new turbines, and we talk about solar a lot, about how it's gotten incrementally better over 15 years, and it's starting to be price competitive in a lot of markets. True. But wind was price competitive 10 years ago. And the new turbines are a kilometer tall. And they tap wind currents that are much stronger and much more reliable. And throughout the Great Plains, especially in West Texas, they're already being used for a fair amount of base load. It's not intermittent anymore if you get high enough. So wind on a dollar per dollar basis generates roughly 3 times the bang for the buck in power as solar does because it's more reliable and it's cheaper. So I'm a big fan of putting wind turbines in the Great Plains, solar in the Southwest, and then having long-range transmission lines to the population centers. I think that the first metro area in the country of size to go 100% green is going to be Dallas-Fort Worth. And it's not because there are any environmentalists in that city. Just Texans can do math. And they are adjacent to both the best solar and the wind zone.
Wow. So since we're talking about geography and we're talking about the United States specifically, and we talked about some of the regions of the United States, you had a series of really interesting slides in your presentation talking about the potential for metro growth in Canada and the United States. You phrase that Anglo-America. And I'm wondering if we could kind of do a quick around the horn in some of those major metro areas and talk about their advantages, their disadvantages, and especially as it relates to this post-China economy as we see over the next decade. We were in Seattle, so if you'd like to start in the greater Seattle metro area, Cascadia, and then we can kind of work our way around the horn, so to speak, from there.
Seattle, the Northwest, is actually one of the areas I'm least excited about. There isn't a lot of land to work with. Portland's up against the mountains. Seattle's on an isthmus. There's no territory expand. So there's no chance of having a greenfield, and there are very few opportunities for brownfield. So for these zones to do well, they have to basically move up the value-added scale at an extreme rate that has to be faster than their labor costs, which is hard to do. So there's legacy stuff like Boeing that is going to do great, especially as Airbus implodes, and things like Microsoft, which don't require the space. It's intellectual work. All of that's great, but they're at a cost structure that is prohibitive. So I don't think they're going to fall, but I don't think they're going to be able to take advantage of much of what is changing in the world.
And you have a similar opinion of the American Northeast, roughly, you know, the DC metro area all the way up to Boston.
Right. I mean, basically, it's going to be the Microsoft model. These are places where the brain work is done, places like MIT and Harvard are. And it's not that that's nothing. It's not that that's important. It's very important. But they don't have the ability to expand. When all you have to work with are urban centers and you can't really put in an industrial park, and that doesn't allow you to take advantage of the fact that we need to double the size of our industrial parks.
So if you just don't have the dirt, it doesn't really matter.
Now, there is more brownfield in this region. And so it's definitely going to see more than what's going to go in, say, the Pacific Northwest. But still, that's not the huge growth story we're going to be seeing elsewhere.
Okay. So you're currently, you call the Front Range home, in the greater Colorado, and then you also kind of lump in the Arizona Sun Corridor. What's going on in that part of the world?
So these are zones that are deserts and near deserts. There is not a lot of small towns around the major population centers. You basically have individual metros that have grown up and expanded as people have moved in from elsewhere in the country. And that's that. It doesn't follow the standard pattern of most of the rest of the country where people move from farm to small town to suburb to inner core. You just have the suburbs and the inner core. Well, that means that a lot of the people who live in these zones are not from there. And a lot of them have moved in, and generally the younger people who are more mobile, and the more mobile of the younger people tend to be better educated. So these are the parts of the country that are demographically younger because of the inward migration and have the highest educational standards for their workforces. They may get trained elsewhere, but then they relocate here to work. So this is where the rubber is meeting the road with the information technology into mass manufacturing. So this is where the semiconductor facilities are primarily going into, and where the application of the finished semiconductors is then put into high manufacturing.
And we kind of skipped California, and I guess we can kind of divide California into two. But I think it'd be, considering we have so many NAOP members in California, between the Bay Area, Northern California, then SoCal being, you know, Orange County, LA, and down to San Diego.
California should be a massive manufacturing story, but it's been 90 years and they still haven't built a high speed rail system between the North and the South. Don't think that's going to happen in the next 5 years. And even if it did, that's the start of the conversation, not the end. They'd have to overhaul a lot of their things just to start to play in what's happening. Now, that doesn't mean there's no manufacturing here. There's a lot of legacy stuff. You could argue that California is either the number one or the number two state for outward value in the sector, but it's all pretty small scale. and their ability to expand the footprint is very limited to the places that are on, say, the edge of the LA sprawl, where you kind of meet in territory that's open. But that means getting out of the basin. And now you're talking about an infrastructure problem in order to link these communities into the greater whole that is Los Angeles. So it's, again, not that they can't play. It's that there's a lot of structural factors that are going to be preventing them from playing largely. There are just other places where it's cheaper and easier and where a lot of the groundwork has already been laid.
The upper Midwest, Chicago, kind of the what's perhaps maybe somewhat derisively called the Rust Belt. Certainly the history of manufacturing is there, but what's the current
situation? Well, let me give you the bad and then the good. So first, okay. The bad. A lot of folks in this area have a hard time with industrial policy. They're not very good at reaching out to potential investors and bringing them in. And they're certainly not good at tailoring their own labor and infrastructure to attract people even once they're there. It's a very hands-off approach, and it's not very effective because this area, for the most part, doesn't have the population density to justify production for its local consumption. So there's always going to be an issue of getting the stuff to where it needs to go. And if you're going to get it to where it needs to go, why don't you just put it close to a larger population center? That said, the Rust Belt has a huge advantage here because it's the Rust Belt. A lot of the legacy infrastructure is already in place. A lot of the legacy of education is already in place. It's got a lot more elbow room, so the birth rate is higher, and the population structure is there to expand the labor force. But I think most importantly is a lot of the large players that died during the Rust Belt era gave birth to a lot of small and medium companies that are a lot more nimble. So if you consider that a lot of the industrial inputs for labor and infrastructure are already here, and most of the players in this space are already small and can adapt quickly, I'm actually pretty positive. The weak point is local government and state government policy to encourage that. They don't have that, and they need to grow it.
So it's a political issue more than anything else in that area.
But it's an easily fixed political issue. This is not like House of Representative crap.
Right. So moving south, the Gulf Coast and Energy Alley, certainly seems like there's a lot of opportunities there. But what's your take?
Absolutely. So let's start with the Gulf Coast and all the energy things. There, most of the hard work is done. This is the place where most of the energy that comes out of the Texas space goes either for export or for processing. Keep in mind that processing is more than oil refineries. It's chemical facilities that make the butadiene and the methanol and all the other stuff that then goes into plastics and styrofoam and insulation and sporting goods equipment and diapers and fertilizer and all the rest. One of the great things of the shale revolution is starting in roughly 2013, we had so much of the stuff that it justified a massive build out of the industrial plant to do that processing. So what we haven't done with copper and nickel and lithium and the rest, we have done with oil and natural gas. And the United States has basically doubled the size of its industrial plant in that space over the last 15 years. And now all those intermediate materials are available to power the next stage of our manufacturing renaissance. So the Europeans can't follow us in this because they never had a shale revolution. And we didn't just produce the raw energy. We were smart enough, wise enough, lucky enough to process it into something that can then be used for everything else that we need to do right now.
That brings us to, I think, the two regions that and correct me if I'm wrong here, but the two regions I think you're probably the most bullish on, and that being the American Piedmont or the American South, Southeast, and then, of course, Texas itself. So let's start with the American Piedmont. That may not be a phrase many people are familiar with. So geographically, what are we talking about there? And then why are you bullish on that region in particular?
Piedmont is the zone between the Appalachians and the ocean, basically Alabama, Georgia, and the Carolinas, a little bit of Virginia in there. These are zones that, for the most part, shouldn't be successful. You've got a lot of racial inequities. You've got a relatively low education base. The infrastructure is limited. The educational system isn't great. And a lot of the cities are inland from the coast, complicating the infrastructure picture. And it's fairly hilly. A lot of them don't even have very good ports. What they have is policy. They have everything that the Midwest doesn't have, and they are very aggressive at seeking out investors, and they are very aggressive at then remaking their own communities in order to put into place what the investors will need. And that allows them to tailor the new infrastructure specifically to the needs of specific would-be investors. I think Charleston, South Carolina is probably the one that's done this the best. They've actually retooled their educational system. So when they find a potential investor, like, you know, tell us the specifics about the jobs that you need to fill. And then they go and they train people in their own community up for those specific jobs. And if the investor hires any of them, then the state gets a fee to help pay for the program. And the rest of them are just released into the workforce. Problem that Charleston has now is it's been so successful that they've gobbled up all of the workforce. And I'm not sure they can expand much more anymore. But that's a great problem.
Fascinating. And I've not even heard anything like that. So that is certainly a magnificent approach to things. And last but certainly not least, and I saw a headline, I don't think it was one of yours, but that Texas will be home to the three largest cities in the United States within the next 25 years. It's going to surpass New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago with Austin, Houston, and the Dallas metroplex area. Your thoughts on that, first of all, is that a bit fanciful?
That might be a little aggressive, but Houston has already passed Chicago.
Right. Right. So are we talking about the new nexus of the United States in that Texas triangle?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no argument there. I mean, the three cities you said plus San Antonio, those are already four of the largest 15 cities in the country. The fastest growing of them in number and percentage terms, sorry, the fastest growing one in percentage terms is Austin, which is now actually a little bit bigger than San Antonio. If you include the whole metro, it's like over 2.5 million people. And the fastest growing one in numerical terms is definitely Houston. And Dallas is not slow. They're just the slowest of the three. So yeah, I don't mean to down talk Dallas, but this is absolutely where it's at. The infrastructure is good and is being expanded as fast as they can. The birth rate is one of the higher in the country, and it is the state that is drawing the most Americans from elsewhere. It has access to Mexican labor, which is critical. It's part of the energy belt, which is critical. It grows its own food, so it has some of the cheapest food costs. It's got a little elbow room, so it's got some of the cheapest land costs. And Houston is also in the Gulf Coast, so it has all of those inputs that I was mentioning before. So this has been economically the fastest growing part of the country for the last 30 years, and it will be for the next 30 years. They've obviously made their bones in energy and automotive, but we're now seeing that expand to basically every type of manufacturing you can possibly imagine. And for most American companies and investors, this is the first stop. Foreign companies, with the exception of Mexico, of course, generally don't come to Texas because the Texans' view of state government is that it shouldn't exist. So the policies that you have in places like the Piedmont or that you need in the Midwest or the legacy intellectualism of the Pacific Northwest or New York, foreigners are coming for that because they know where to hang their hat in that sort of relationship. But Texas just doesn't show up to the meeting. The Texas legislature meets for 35 days every other year and that for lawmaking purposes. And that's it. If you need something changed, forget it. But if you're looking for a place where the regulations are relatively light and nothing needs to be changed, you know, here you are. So Americans are far more comfortable in that environment than foreigners who kind of want to understand the playing field a little bit. And I'm not suggesting that the Texans honestly need to change anything because their model is working very well. And their problem is an embarrassment of riches when it comes to investments that are incoming, not an issue of attracting more.
And since we're on Texas, and I think this is something that my eyes have been open to as the global economy changes, is the enormous advantage that we as the United States have, having Mexico as a neighbor and an ally and a trading partner. And there was an entire section of your presentation that we didn't quite get to last week that dealt with Mexico and their urban areas and their geography and populations. And I'm wondering if we could take just a couple minutes talking about the strategic importance of Mexico as, well, trading partner, ally, someone who's going to help us get through this massive realignment of the global order.
Well, let me start by saying Mexico is not an ally. Ally is willing to bleed for you a little bit. This is a partner. This is maybe a friend.
Okay,
this
fair,
is definitely
fair.
Family. But they are not an ally.
Not an ally. Okay, fair
There's
enough.
There's a lot
enough.
Of bad blood under that particular bridge.
Fair enough.
But they are definitely a partner. Most of the, I'd say about 40% of the American economic success story since the mid-1990s has been specifically the integration of the northern Mexican states with Texas. It has been a huge success story so far. The labor system is complementary, and the populations on the border states, places like Juarez and Monterrey and Tijuana, and their integration north has been great because they're good at things that we're not good at. We're great at the intellectual work. We have a lot of the raw materials here. We do the processing. The Mexicans kind of do the stuff that's in the middle. And in that, they are the most competitive workforce in the world, easily twice as effective as Chinese labor at the same job. And once you merge that with the infrastructure, the population structure, the energy inputs and everything else in Texas, it's something that honestly we couldn't screw up if we tried. The challenge we're going to have moving forward is twofold. So number one, a little bit like Colorado, a little bit like Arizona, the populations of Mexico are in arid zones. And so you've got these population cores and then you just hit desert. So once you've gobbled up all of the labor in a specific area, you're done and you've got to move to the next town. And oftentimes the next town is several hundred miles away. They don't have constellations of small cities like we do because there's no farms. Farms take water and it's a desert. On the upside, when you have a sequestered population center like that, you have a pretty oligarchic decision-making process, especially when it comes to economic matters. And so if you're an American and you're looking for a business partner, you go down to Mexico, you will find out who's in charge very, very quickly, and you cut a deal with them and you get brought into the family and they have their fingers in everything. And so everything can be sorted out in a matter of days, as opposed to if you do this in the States, it might take months or even years if you're in a place like California. The same people who write the regulatory structure are showing up for the family reunion. And that just makes things simple. The challenge we're going to have with Mexico is reach. Because Texas has not been sleeping these last 30 years, and they've metabolized almost all of the available labor in the north. The next big labor source is in the greater Mexico City region. Now, that has twice as much labor as the north. It's a big zone to metabolize, but you have to get there first. And that means the Mexicans need to build some serious multimodal systems to get not just to the border region, but all the way from Texas down to the Mexico City core itself. If that were to start today, I don't think we'd be able to begin operation until at least late 2025. And so I would say that this is the biggest single thing limiting our ability to do what we need in a cross-border method is building that infrastructure. On our side of the border, I'd say the biggest single biggest limiting factor is electricity generation. Because even if we drop the green transition altogether, just adding the new industrial plant and the new processing, you know, that's, you're talking like a 50% increase in the amount of juice we're going to need. That's another thing you can't do overnight.
So I've really enjoyed this conversation, Peter. And there is just, I mean, literally the new book, the End of the World is Just the Beginning. I'm about 2/3 of the way through it. I wish I could say I was all the way through it.
Oh, you're not to the depressing part yet then.
Oh, good. So I have something to look forward to. I know because I do skip ahead that it does end on a somewhat hopeful note in terms of, you know, looking forward and what's on the other side of all this. So I want to end with our listeners maybe a little less depressed. You actually are pretty optimistic about the future, especially of North America and kind of how things will look after we get through this very interesting transition period. And I think it might make sense to close on that. So how do you see things sorting out, say, 15, 20 years from now?
We are already not just self-sufficient, but the world's largest producer and exporter of food and energy products. So, you know, the baseline stuff is already covered here and everything is honestly upside. And if we're going to double the size of our industrial plant to make our own stuff, we're going to have shorter supply chains with more security and fewer steps that use less energy and less capital and less labor and is more effective at everything, but employs locals and sells to locals and is largely immune to international shocks. This is going to be inflationary. This is going to be a rough ride. We're going to have to do things faster and do things that we've never done before, very fast. But we're going to generate the fastest economic growth in the history of the continent while doing it. This isn't a good story. This is a phenomenal story. It's just that it's not a straight line from here to there.
And as I think we both know, history seldom is, but
history is messy.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And we're in the middle of it right now. You have some excellent resources on your website and some daily updates and some newsletters. If our listeners want to hear more and get more of your content, how would they go about doing that?
Zehian.com is the website, and Zehian.com/newsletter is how you sign up for the newsletter and the video logs. It is free, and I will never share your data with anyone.
Outstanding. Peter, thank you so very much on behalf of NAOP and myself. I've enjoyed this conversation a great deal. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Not a problem. You take care.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody, for listening to Inside CRE with me, your guest host, Christopher Ware. If you enjoyed this podcast and you'd like to help support it, please share it with others and be sure to subscribe. Special thanks again to our podcast sponsor, Avis & Young. That's all for this episode. I look forward to talking with you again soon. Thanks.